Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
All right, welcome everyone to a possibly very long episode of Reconsider, part of the Agora Podcast Network, where we don't do the thinking for you. I'm just going to kind of like mea culpa right now that as the world has just, you know, caught fire, literally and figuratively, in a number of ways, we've, you know, Xander and I have been like, okay, let's like focus, you know, let's like not chase the news. Let's focus on stuff that is going to have a big impact. And, you know, I worry that we might have come off as a bit out of touch saying like, hey, look, does the U.S. fight rational wars? And what if the Fed, you know, like, let's talk about the Fed right now, right? Like, now's a great time to talk about what the Fed could do. And so we decided to get a little more topical and just like run straight at things today. The thing we're not running at is the president's health and coronavirus. That is just a matter of like, do we have all the information? And the answer is no. But what we are going to talk about are the president's now numerous and increasingly diverse suggestions about how he's not really planning to respect the outcome of the election. His team's efforts kind of from like prepping, you know, trying to get delegates to vote to electoral college delegates to vote for him, even if he loses, to just arresting Biden, which would be convenient. So we'll talk about some of those efforts. We'll discuss what the end game could look like. And then we're going to, this may end up being a second episode. We'll see. But I want to talk a little bit of like, how did it come to this, right? Like how do you have 42% of the country supporting a guy who just says he doesn't plan to respect the outcome of the election and just, you know, and did what he could to try to just arrest his political rival and put him in jail before the election, all that stuff. Like, how did it come to this? I want to talk a little bit about media technology and how that's evolved as a possible hypothesis for it.
Yeah. And you threw out a mea culpa. I'll throw out another mea culpa. Probably part of the reason we haven't gotten to a more topical episode somewhat more early is in part because, like many of you folks, I've just been extremely overwhelmed by all of this, and it's been grating on my mental health a little bit. So, and you know, I have done this professionally for several years, so it's a difficult time. Eric, you've been an inspiring figure through this because you've been just putting your head down and doing the work, getting involved in the ways that you need to. And out of everyone that I know, Eric's been more optimistic, or maybe more energized, or a combination of both than many others. Yeah. So that's where we are. But we're here to chat because we need to.
So today is the 10th of October, 2020. Biden has opened up his biggest lead in the race so far, 10.1 points, according to 538's trends. And I believe an 85% likelihood of winning the election, up from a low of like 67, where currently he's, you know, projected to take everything from Pennsylvania, Florida, Arizona, North Carolina, Ohio, and he's knocking on the door of Georgia, of all places. It's looking really bad for the president, and this spike recently came after the first debate, which was, you know, well, you either saw it or you didn't. At the first debate and the president getting the coronavirus, probably very bad timing for him because the coronavirus had just started to kind of go off the airways, and it was something that he could hopefully ignore, and then he got it. And so Biden's lead is big. And 10 points may not seem like a lot, But the last time, Xander, do you know the last time a United States presidential election had the winner getting more than 10% more of the national vote than the second place guy?
I don't. Enlighten me.
You don't want to guess?
More than 10% more than the next guy. Yeah. Was it Nixon?
No, it was actually sooner than that. It was Reagan Mondale.
Oh, okay.
If Reagan Mondale, I'll actually just bring it up live here. Was that 1988? And 1988. Yep, there we go. Sorry, it was 1984 because 1988 was Bush Dukakis. 1984, 58.8% to 40.6. So it was a 18-point win for Reagan over Mondale, winning every single state. Winning 49 out of 50 states, not carrying Minnesota because Mondale was the governor of Minnesota. And Minnesota's weird. So can you imagine, you know, so that's not going to happen this election. But nothing has been a 10-point difference since then. It could very well happen. So in part because you still have this kind of like 4%. So you take 52 and 42, add them up, right? You get 94. You get about 2%. They're going to vote for Jorgensen Hawkins. You get that 4% left. And look, honestly, I'm an eternal optimist, but I suspect that President Biden is going to slurp up a larger portion of that than 4% than Mr. Trump. And so the guy could really be sitting there with like 55% of the vote to like 43 or something. And it would just be, you know, it would be a shellacking. The Democrats are in a good position to be able to take back the Senate. 538 currently gives them a more than 67% chance, last time I checked, of winning the Senate, averaging about 51 seats. Sorry, 68 now. It's gone up. Averaging 51 seats. The toss-ups being Iowa and... Well, the toss-up is Iowa, but then you have all these like slight lean Republicans in Georgia, Kansas, and Montana that the Democrats are trying to come after. So if there's like a 1 or 2 point shift in the Democrats' favor there, they could end up with like 53 or 54. So it's looking like and it's worth noting that, you know, the Senate's weird because you only vote for a third of them at any given period of time. And in 2018, the Democrats actually like disappointed. They didn't do as well as they could have. And in 2018, kind of everyone was writing, there's really no chance that the Democrats take back the Senate in 2020. Now it's looking, you know, 2-1 odds that they will. So bad time for the Republicans.
Bad time. And a lot of Republican senators are beginning to distance themselves from the president. And that's something that you don't see too often when the president is in the same party as the senator that's running, right? Because often the president gets so much more media attention, right, that senators and congressmen will hitch themselves to the presidential bandwagon, and that relation is beginning to tether a little bit, with even Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell starting to very clearly say that he follows different health guidelines than the president, and start to distance himself a little bit in that way. But, you know, that's also kind of reading the tea leaves a little bit. So who knows specifically? Now, I want to play devil's advocate a little bit, Eric, in part because you're more familiar with the numbers than I am, because you've just been following the election data like a hawk, which I appreciate. Yeah, exactly. Now, Biden has an 85% chance, according to 538.
Yep.
Some folks are probably unfamiliar with 538. It's a meta-analysis, mm-hmm, essentially, of multiple different polls. Folks who are familiar with 538 may say, yeah, sure, but didn't they say Clinton had a 75% chance of winning in 2016? Why might that, what problems may there be with that response, and what's different in the numbers between this election and the last one?
Great question. So a couple things are different. One of them is that they actually had Hillary as high as like 90% at some point early on, and she went down to like 72 just before election day. And then lost. So a couple things are different. One of them is that if the polls stay the same, if all the polls stay exactly the same, Biden's chance of victory closer to the election is going to go up. because the, you know, you can say with greater confidence that things are less likely to change a day before the election than a month out. So what that means is that so the 15% that Trump has is like largely depending on just the uncertainty of time. Like something could happen, right? You could get a Comey moment. And so it's clear that Biden has a much wider margin, both nationally and in the states that matter, than Clinton had by a lot. So his polling versus Trump in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Nevada, Minnesota, Michigan, Florida, Arizona, North Carolina, Ohio is all way, way, way better than Clinton by like five to 7 points. Huge difference. And so what that means is like, if these are the polls the day before the election, Biden's chance of victory, according to 538's meta-analysis, I think it's like a Monte Carlo simulation on crack, is going to be higher than 85%. So that's one thing is that. And then the other thing is that polling methodologies have changed. So the way that 538 rates these polls and weights, you know, weights these polls has changed based on the fact that, you know, turnout for different demographic groups is a little bit different in 2016 than people predicted. So the polls were off, like to say the polls were off is like kind of true. They were off by about 2 to 3 points, and they've now largely adjusted for that. So they'll be off in some way, right? Because they're just predicting a certain demographic turnout basket, right? And I'm sure it will be different in some way. But it's not going to be wrong for the same reasons. It could even be wrong in the opposite direction, right? It could be that, you know, more Black Americans turn out than the poll weighting predicts, or more young Americans turn out or something like that. So what that means is like the systemic bias that was true in 2016 has been corrected for. Something may be off a little bit, but certainly compared to 2016, like this is not a close race. This is very, very much Biden's to lose.
Right. So it's not looking great for Trump, and he's essentially acting that way in a lot of ways. Certainly after he became ill with COVID, he has been acting desperately in a lot of ways. I mean, the example that's coming immediately to mind is, I think it was like the day he returned to the White House from Walter Reed. Or maybe it's while he was still in the hospital. I can't even keep track anymore. But right. He just had like this Twitter storm, which is not unusual for the president, but it was just all caps with essentially non sequiturs. It's like lower taxes, vote. Dislike X, vote. Law and order, vote. Yeah. And, you know, it's very much the actions of someone who's desperate and feeling backed into a corner, which, you know, for someone who has threatened to not accept a peaceful transition of power is a little worrisome. Right. And the example that's been coming to my mind, or the idea that feels very relevant, is this idea of prospect theory. And if you've read Thinking Fast and Slow, Daniel Kahneman, great book. Prospect theory is basically the idea that we don't weight positive developments the same degree as we weight negative developments. And again, weight, W-E-I-G-H-T. So if you have less to lose, you're more likely to gamble. And if you have a lot to lose, then you're more likely to be conservative with your actions because you don't want to lose that stuff. So backed into a corner, potentially looking at the prospect of not only losing, but then being prosecuted in state court, Trump clearly feels like he has a lot to lose.
Yeah, let's go into that prosecution bit too, because I think this is very relevant here. Because frankly, like, look, why should Trump be so desperate to hang on to power? And ultimately, it's that the guy has very clearly just committed a lot of crimes while in office. You know, the choice to repeatedly engage foreign powers to attempt to sway the election is criminal. It's a crime. I mean, even like he's committed so many crimes, you can't even keep track of them all. And they're also brazen. So like, for example, using the White House as a campaign stop. Or it's like a rally, is illegal. It is a crime.
Yeah.
Him using his position as president to promote the Goya bean brand is a crime, right? Yeah. It is a crime you go to jail for. And as we saw from the New York Times tax returns, or the report on his tax returns, he has been using his position as president. Probably literally nobody is surprised by this, like even his supporters, to get, you know, his position as president to get more people to go to his like resorts at Mar-a-Lago and such for, you know, official meetings and or to like stay there while trying to, you know, visit the president. A lot of them are like foreigners, but a lot of them are just like domestic people who want, you know, political favors. And that is a crime, right? It's called corruption, right? Mm-hmm. It is classic graft. And it's criminal, right? People should go to jail for that because it's illegal. And, you know, and so look, the president, I'm sure after he loses the election, is either going to pardon himself or try to resign and hope Pence pardons him, because that is pardoning oneself is legally iffy. The president pardoning you while you're a private citizen is not legally iffy. So he might resign to get Pence to pardon him, but he's committed enough crimes in enough different states, including New York. I mean, one thing we know is that like the IRS is coming after him for $70 million that he may have fraudulently gotten from committing tax fraud. He got $70 million in returns or refunds from the government. That is a crime, right? You go to jail for it. And so the president can only pardon someone for national crimes, but there are plenty of state crimes that he's committed, and Pence or Biden couldn't protect him from those. Right. And it very much seems like the New York Attorney General is going to go after him. So the guy wants to avoid jail time, long story short. And also he's got $400 million in debt or $450 million in debt to somebody that will be coming up at some point. And it's entirely possible he's just kind of, again, he's desperate. So what do? You just try to, you try to push off the inevitable and, you know, and hope it works out for you. So there's a little bit of like speculating about what's going on in the guy's head. However, if you are in a position where like you can't be prosecuted, and when you lose that position, you can be prosecuted, it's pretty obvious you want to hold on to power for personal reasons.
Exactly. And before we hop into this bit about partisan framing, which is, you know, we try to do a little bit of that every episode. It's kind of how we introduce our topics. I wanted to mention to you the new Dan Carlin podcast. Fans of Dan Carlin, he came out with a recent Common Sense episode, which is exciting in part because he has been doing a lot of common sense lately, and he does hardcore history, which is his long form, like novellas essentially. And Common Sense is like an hour long or so podcast. And he has been doing it because he's just been like, I don't even know what I have to add anymore. But one thing that he said that has really made me think, because I have been personally on the fence about whether or not it would be a good idea to start prosecuting presidents, in part because, you know, that can very quickly deteriorate into a political process, and you would have to have independent oversight. It'd have to be managed by the Justice Department. Something Dan Carlin said is like, you know, when I look at the Mongols, and all of a sudden you're thinking, what does that have to do with anything? But of course, yes, when I look at the Mongols, they would come and they would completely, utterly conquer a town, but they would never encircle it entirely. They would always leave like a lane for traffic to pass through. And the idea, he said, was the Mongols didn't want their enemies to fight to the death because they would lose fewer men. They would get it quicker. It would be less costly for them. They would take over the city and hold it. And like that, he was essentially arguing that there should be some sort of escape valve for Trump, because it's just better if he gets out, he's out of the office, we don't have to worry about him anymore, rather than encouraging him to fight to the death. Whether that's figurative or literal, I actually don't know. But I think I find it difficult to believe right now that he doesn't try to question the veracity of the election unless he wins, honestly. So I think that may be coming either way, but I don't know. That's my two cents. I don't know what's going to happen. No one does, right?
I think part of it is it's very hard to create that exit ramp, right? Yeah. So like what can, you know, because Biden could say all he wants publicly, all, you know, like Trump has lied so often to everyone that if Biden says, hey, look, man, when I win, I'm not going to prosecute you, just step down, Trump will be like, yeah, you can say that all you want. But yeah,
that's true.
You might still do it. And how are you going to stop New York from prosecuting me? And how are you going to stop Florida from prosecuting me? So the, you know, Biden or the Justice Department or someone like may not have the power or ability to give reasonable reassurances to the president that he won't be prosecuted on his way out. And I think the counterposition to that is, you know, is if the guy's going to fight anyway, right? Or maybe it doesn't matter whether he fights, but, you know, but I think the counterposition to that is like, do you need to deter future potential presidents from committing crimes while in office?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if they know that they won't be prosecuted, if there's a tradition of not prosecuting presidents while they're in power, you know, then they literally are above the law.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The only reason they would follow the law is because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, that politicians do that all the time.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so what's the framing here? We get to the election, Eric, and I guess the narrative on one side is clear, but the narrative on the other side, that the legitimacy of the election may be called into question. What does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I remember, for a little bit of context, you know, I remember it was somewhere between like the like Louis DeJoy, USPS debacle, and
Yes, those halcyon days of yore 2 months ago.
Right. Well, somewhere between then and now, or between then and Trump saying, you know what, just arrest Biden, fuck it, right? Like, I'm out of options. Somewhere between there was this like peak. I felt this peak in anxiety from my friends. A lot of people were coming to me, my mother, friends of mine, saying, do I need to buy a gun? It may have been like around Kenosha, Wisconsin, around that time. Like, do I need to buy a gun? Is there going to be fighting in the streets? Oh, you know what it was? Sorry. It was the debate. It was when Trump said, stand by, right?
Yeah.
Stand by, Proud Boys. That was the moment. Everyone's like, oh God, like there's no good outcome here, right? It's just going to get ugly because the president is going to, I'll be getting to the partisan positioning in a second here, but the president is going to like unleash the dogs of war. And of course you could say, yeah, well, I mean, you know, don't overhype it. But then the FBI revealed that it arrested 10 people who were engaged in a plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan and put her on a trial of the people. Because President Trump didn't like her and was like, liberate Michigan, right? So like the what we realize from that is that the president has a frightening amount of power with a particular group of people to like, with a tweet, get them to do crazy things.
Yeah.
So he's kind of like a baby with a gun in that sense. And, you know, and you really can't take the gun from his hands because it's Twitter. Maybe you kick him off Twitter or something because he's inciting violence. I don't know. But actually, it's not a bad idea. But anyway, and so that kind of peak of anxiety was there that, okay, he's going to contest the election. White nationalists with guns are going to like run around shooting people. And also like people were sharing these articles about like kind of these wacky paths that Trump could like lose the election big time, but still end up president. So what's going on? I think the way that the left is thinking about it is that, well, look, there's no particular reason to believe that the vote is going to be rigged in some way, that like there's going to be ballot box stuff. You know, the president hasn't been very specific about the details, of course, but that, you know, their position right now is like, OK, there's not going to be like ballot stuffing. There is, of course, going to be voter suppression going on. And, you know, there's this fight over how many ballot drop boxes per county are going to be in Texas, which is still ongoing. So the left believes like, okay, the Democratic vote, especially in cities, is going to be suppressed by states that lean Democratic but have a Republican legislature. And then we're going to win anyway because we're polling so well. And then Trump is going to contest the election and he's like going to find some way to cheat and maybe win it. But maybe if he doesn't, you know, white nationalists are going to flood the streets and just start killing everyone. So it's not what everyone on the left thinks, but I've heard a lot of it, and I think everyone's willing to like entertain that any of these things could be true. And then on the right, the partisan positioning is, you know, hey, look, in 2016, 3 to 5 million votes were illegally cast by somebody, something like illegal immigrants, for Hillary Clinton, and I won anyway. Isn't that amazing? And this is true, even though I sent the Department of Justice to investigate my claims and they found nothing. It's still true. And that 2020 is going to be the most fraudulent election in history because it's very easy to commit voting fraud using mass mail-in balloting. And so the Democrats and or foreign powers you know, I've heard stuff about like the Chinese just like shipping millions of votes somehow to.
It's always China. It's always their fault.
China. And so the Chinese are somehow going to like ship millions of ballots for Joe Biden, and Biden is going to steal, you know, the Democrats, TM, are going to steal the election that way. And there's no, you know, there's no evidence, but I don't need it. And yeah, and that's coming from the president. Although what's interesting is most GOP leaders are trying to stay mum on it. So it's really like there's a number of angles here. There's Trump's angle and the, you know, and the kind of people that just believe whatever Trump says. There's the Democrats' angle, and then there's like the GOP kind of like quietly, desperately hoping that Trump can like, and you know, fire people up to come out and vote again. But they know they're playing with fire, and they're quietly encouraging people to use mail-in ballots anyway, even though Trump's saying not to, because they don't want to lose the election. So it's, you know, it's a little heated right now. But short version is there's going to be voter fraud by the Democrats, or Trump is going to try to steal the election after losing through various methods that we can get into.
Okay, so let's hop into some of those claims. Those constructs. Those, yeah, parts. Now, the thing about voting fraud, we actually already looked into that in quite a bit of detail. Mm-hmm. We have an episode about it. We have a long form investigative report on it on our website, reconsidermedia.com. We even made a video about it. The almost all large claims of voter fraud stem from this organization called the Public Interest Legal Foundation, or PILF for short. They actually call themselves that. And the head of the organization is affiliated with Donald Trump. He's been appointed by Trump to sit on different official committees or commissions. And they PILF also has a history of just straight up getting the data wrong and having to issue corrections afterwards. And unsurprisingly, the mistakes that they made supported the positions that they were trying to push. So there really is not a lot of voter fraud. Yes, it happens, but on a scale that matters, essentially not consequential. And if you want the details of that, go check out our long form report. We actually, you know, we looked at all the articles citing all the different data that we can find about this and went and found the original reports and read through them. So voter fraud's not really an issue. Now, Eric, the point you mentioned about right-wing nationalist militias, I have to admit, I was pretty scared and continue to be fairly scared about that. And
right.
Part of the reason has been for me, and I still don't think that Weimar Germany is a very good comparison to the US. And I'll mention a couple of points, but people have been making that comparison forever, right?
Right.
Certainly since Trump's come to office. And it always goes like something Trump did I didn't like, therefore Nazi Germany. And there are so many historical differences between the U.S. today and Weimar Germany, perhaps the most pressing being that the Weimar Republic was only a couple years old when Hitler came to power. It only started being a republic in 1919. Germany only became a country in 1870, and it was a monarchy up until after World War I. Very different today. We have a long tradition of Republican institutions going through very shaky times. So that's a difference. But one of the things that I've always said is the difference between today and then is you don't have roving bands of brown shirts. You don't have an independent source of force that is unconnected to official government structures.
Right.
And the fact that the president is now very publicly saying that he supports the idea of armed militias. I don't know what else you call the Proud Boys. They are an armed militia group. Going to polling stations on election night to look over people's shoulders is extraordinarily disconcerting to me, and there's no other way around it. And I think that counts as one similarity. It's not good. I don't think there's anywhere around it. Right. What do you think about that?
I mean, I agree it's not good. I think one major difference with the brown shirts and now is that the brown shirts had the backing of the state. Remember that Trump is not the state. Trump mm-hmm. is a major actor in the state, but the police forces are controlled by the sovereign states of America. There is a national police force that is not, you know, and there's the military. Blessedly, our military is like, we're not getting involved. Leave us mm-hmm. out of it. It is probably the most important institution or institutional consistency that we have going for us right now, that the military is like, not getting involved. And I think that's part of the reason there's not going to be a civil war, a capital C, capital W civil war. The president, you know, are there going to be, are militias going to show up to voting stations? Possibly. One of the things to keep in mind is that they're not particularly well organized. and, you know, the groups of them. And there aren't all that many of them. And they would be opposed by the police. Right. So I don't see, unlike Weimar Republic or, say, Afghanistan, or the Roman Republic, where there was no police, right? There's no police. So Roman Republic, no police, just armed bands of maniacs with clubs. Weimar Republic, these guys were backed by the police. Afghanistan, insufficient police power compared to the Taliban, right? And so you had, you know, you had mass voter intimidation in all three of these situations. Is there going to be mass voter intimidation here? I don't think so. I think it's going to be dramatic, because I think some people are going to try, but I don't think there's enough. There's enough organization, and I don't think there are enough of them in enough places to have a huge impact. So, for example, the Proud Boys, there are a couple thousand of them. They're just particularly nasty. Mm-hmm. And now there may be far more sympathizers, but there are a couple thousand Proud Boys throughout the country. Now there are many, many other militias. There are the 3%ers who are bigger. But I don't think you can get the level of organization that you had with the Brown Shirts. And I think another key difference is, we talked about this in another podcast episode about political violence, is that the Brown Shirts and the communists each had their own roving bands of armed thugs all fighting each other. And it was, and I think a key part of both the fall of the Roman Republic and the Weimar Republic was you had mass extended street fighting from two armed sides, where the average person then said, just bring in a strong man to make it go away, right? Mm-hmm. I am unsafe. People I know are dying. And when Caesar said, or I guess even like Crassus said, like, look, I'm just going to put a lid on it. And was like, great, come on in, right? Or when Hitler said, I'm just going to put a lid on it. Oh, and by the way, the Reichstag burned down. It's probably those dirty communists, right? It was a little more credible, because people had this experience of people running around burning stuff to the ground. So it's scary that we're having this conversation, but I do think that there are some important key differences, and the important key difference is this: the state and the American states still have a powerful police force that is very easy to organize, that stands for the state, as much as there are, of course, like people friendly to white supremacy in the police force. These police forces are not allies of white nationalist militias, and have the ability to preserve law and order in a way that some of our historical examples either chose not to or were unable to.
We do know that some police agencies have cooperated with militia groups that have been predominantly white. I forget which city this was in, but I remember reading about it and seeing photos that essentially verified it. There's no sign that that's systemic across the country. One other thing that I'll mention from the recent Common Sense podcast that I thought was an interesting comparison was that one of the main reasons that Caesar decided to cross the Rubicon is because he was heavily indebted and knew if he lost power, he was going to be prosecuted and possibly at that point in history just killed by his political opponents.
100%.
So he said, screw it, whatever. You know, I don't have a whole lot to lose. Let's see what happens if I roll the dice.
Yes. Oh, and surely Trump's going to try the same thing.
100%.
And one major difference, of course, is that there was that as much as, you know, at the same time, Rome lacked a police force, it also at the time lacked a military force that was loyal to Rome because of the, was it Crassus that did it first? No, Marius, because of the Marian reforms.
Marius and Sulla. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Not Crassus. It was Sulla. Sorry. Blech. Anyway, Mike Duncan is rolling his eyes at me. But because of the Marian reforms, armies were loyal personally to these generals, and there was not a tradition of armed forces defending the Republic. There was, but it was gone, right?
Yeah, it was before.
Yeah, before the Punic Wars, that was true. The Punic Wars depleted the ranks of the Republican legions, both because people died and because people's farms failed and they had to sell them, and you needed to join the legions, you had to have land. And so Marius was like, what if I just form my own legions from people who don't have land and just gave them loot because the Senate won't pay for them? And that's how that all happened. So there are we're like, we are blessed right now that some of our key institutions that are designed to preserve the peace and, you know, have a fairly large monopoly on power, they remain neutral and I don't want to say Republican, but like, but backing of our institutions and traditions.
It is good that the U.S. government pays the salaries of people in the military.
Exactly. And they continue in their tradition of saying, look, I it doesn't matter if the president says, hey, just keep me in power. They're going to say, no, not our job. I think so is street violence possible? I think it's even likely at this point, just given what we saw about the militias. Sorry, these guys are terrorists, right? Like they're using violence to try to change politics. Like the guys who wanted to kidnap Megan Whitmer are terrorists. Anyone who wants to like bring guns to a polling location to intimidate voters is a terrorist. That is the definition of terrorism. Like literally.
Even according to the government's definition, right? Like it is using force for political motives.
Exactly. Exactly.
The end.
The end. Yeah. So is there going to be political terrorism? Probably. Is it going to be ugly? Yes. Are people going to die? Yes. Is Trump going to be able to steal the election? Probably not with guns. And if there's a, I happen to think, we can get into this. Oh, sorry, we've got a whole section. What happens if Trump contests the election? So I think the other thing we do need to look into is like mail-in voting a little bit, because the I think it's unfortunate because there's this kind of like crack that lets some daylight through where like 10 ballots were inadvertent, were mistakenly thrown out in Pennsylvania. And seven of the votes, or maybe nine ballots, but seven of the votes happened to be for Trump. And so we've got this example. Now, of course, they were recovered and they're going to be counted, but, but kind of too late. And of course, the guy who did that has been fired. But this example that is real, you know, it's just like with any propaganda, you get this example that is real and use it to paint this picture that there's this widespread thing going on when there's no reason to think that there is this widespread thing going on. I think the what's kind of amazing about the mass voter fraud assumption here is that it depends on like this assumption that everyone handling the voting process just like wants Democrats to win, one, and two, is willing to cheat. That like somehow the Democrats have this like monopoly lock on the voting process, from the United States Postal Service to counting the votes to all this stuff, and that they're all kind of in cahoots to get Biden elected. And it just, of course, as soon as you start to challenge that significantly and ask for any evidence, it falls apart. But, it's one of the president's fortes is being able to make a emotionally compelling case without presenting evidence to support it. But I think that's the ultimate downfall of this kind of like mass voter fraud claim, is that it would need to be very one-sided. And in the places that matter, like, for example, Pennsylvania, right, is Trump going to claim that there was massive voter fraud in Pennsylvania when he loses the state? Probably. Well, who, is the legislature, which appoints all the people who handle the elections, is it Republican or Democrat? Well, it's Republican. Same thing with Wisconsin. Same thing with Florida, right? So if he loses Florida, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, he's going to claim that the Democrats stole the election, even though the Republicans ran the election. So, I think it would be wrong of us not to at least address this claim. But it breaks down fairly quickly as soon as you put any light on it. And, I think the last thing I want to say about it before we move on to like what happens if Trump contests the election is, we made the case earlier that Louis DeJoy was probably, or I at least made the case, I think from the balance of analysis or the balance of evidence, that like Louis DeJoy was not involved in the month of June in a conspiracy to undermine the United States presidential election by being a little bit more aggressive about removing sorting capacity than his predecessors. However, it does seem clear that Trump does want, like, Trump is probably worried about, you know, worried about mail-in voting leading to him losing by more, in part because, look, turnout for poorer Americans who tend to vote Democratic and Black Americans who tend to vote Democratic is lower. There are a lot of states where, by design, there are fewer voting machines, fewer opportunities for them to vote. It's called, you know, it's voter suppression. And mail-in balloting makes it easy, right? You just have to, I already did it. Filled out the thing, ship it, done. And, you know, so what it means is that you're likely to get an increase in a historical increase in turnout of people who otherwise had difficulty voting. And by the way, most of them vote Democrat. So, of course, Trump knows that this the historical moment of mail-in balloting makes it harder to suppress the vote, makes it harder to win the election where the race would be close. And so, of course, he wants to undermine it. There's also some evidence that I got from a study that USA Today published that a poll that Biden voters are likely by a margin of 2-1 to use mail-in voting versus Trump voters. So if you can get that whole, if you can, you know, if you're sitting there scheming and saying, how can I possibly win this election? If you can, you know, get a court to, or someone to say like, you know what, all these mail-in votes, like it's just such a mess. We just have to throw them all out. Right. It's a good tactic. So, so yeah, it's ugly and it's going to be ugly, but I think from what we can see, there's no particular reason to think that there's going to be either one massive fraud or even two, as we covered in the USPS episode that we did. It doesn't seem that like the United States Postal Service is going to like just lose a bunch of ballots, or like they're going to like catch fire, end up in a hole somewhere because of the reduction in capacity. And, you know, there are certainly going to be a few instances. It depends state by state. Like some of them, you know, some states like will count every ballot if it's postmarked by election day. So even if it's late, right, it'll still get voted. Some of them, it has to show up by 3 days after election day, at which point, if you submit your mail-in ballot late and the USPS is a little bit backed up, it might not get counted. How big is that going to be? We don't know. And could it otherwise tip the election? Maybe. Probably not if Biden has this big a lead, which is kind of the like, that's the kind of thing. Like, I think if we look back on this election and say, how did we get through with our heads on straight? It was that it wasn't close, right? Mm-hmm. It was that we didn't go in expecting a close election and we didn't get one. And that's kind of because it will, if it's not close, it makes all these opportunities to try to like challenge the election, which we're about to talk about, much harder to execute.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So what does it look like if Trump challenges the election? And here, just based on the polls, I think our analysis is working on the assumption that he loses and then subsequently contests the election. That might not happen. We can't predict the future. But this seems like a plausible scenario right now. The votes that come in, maybe not plausible, but possible. The votes that come in on election night on November 3rd lean towards Trump because of the statistic that, Eric, you just talked about, Biden voters 2-1 and likely to vote by mail. And some of those ballots might come in really early this year, or they might not. And they might come in late. And if that happens, Trump could easily make the case that, okay, look, I've won. He makes that announcement on the evening of November 3rd. even if a lot of large media companies are not reporting on the win at that point because there is such a delay. I don't know if they're going to do that, but some of them have talked about it.
Right.
And then if the numbers change, that is when the claims of fraud would potentially come in. And, you know, the narrative is kind of clear. It's like, oh, the numbers were saying one thing and then they weren't, you know, fake news, something, something. It's a fraud, whatever. At the same time, I mean, there's not a whole lot to substantiate this, right?
Right.
Especially because we know that the president has said the only way that this is a legitimate victory is if I win.
Right.
And I mean, that's the extreme of a political ploy if you've ever heard one, right?
Right. I have to interrupt for a moment. What is, I think the thing I am sad about, and like, you know, hey, Trump voters, if you're listening, like, I'd actually love for you to like write me. Like, I promise I won't pick a fight with you. I'm just got better things to do than fight, but I do want to like fight with like one random American or 10. But I am really interested, like, when you've got a guy who's sitting there saying, like, you know what? The only way that this outcome is legitimate is if I win, and otherwise I will contest it. When you've got a guy who is, you know, gone to Pennsylvania, said, hey, look, even if I lose Pennsylvania, how about you guys just throw me the electoral votes anyway? When you've got a guy who said, you know what, let's just arrest Biden, right? 26 days before the election, let's just arrest the guy and tell the world, you know, he told the world that he said, let's just arrest the guy. How do you support him? Like, how do you vote for him? I do want someone to like try to, I want to hear the case, right? And I'm not going to agree with it. You kind of know where I stand about this personally, but I think everyone who listens to this show is like abnormally smart and abnormally thoughtful and self-examining. And I'm sure there are some Trump voters who listen to this who are like, you know, or who like listen to this episode right now, just like kind of grinding their teeth. And maybe we're even doing the president a disservice somehow. And so I think it's important for, I want to understand it, but you know, this may also be a good opportunity for us to print some sort of retraction that like maybe the president isn't planning to arrest his political rivals and throw them in jail in order to not lose the election. I don't know. But I'd love to hear your perspective. Sorry, continue, Zander.
No, that's great. If you email Eric, CC me, Eric@reconsidermedia.com. That's Eric with a K, and Xander@reconsidermedia.com. We've printed retractions before. We will invariably do it again in the future because we're right. Human beings and we make a mistake. And I keep coming back to, I think that's the one thing that's missing in our public sphere is the ability to just be people to say, oh, I was wrong.
Yeah.
And we talk about this a lot in our Reconsider Principles and Discussion Strategies, which if you haven't picked up a copy yet, just subscribe to our newsletter. You'll get them for free. And one thing we say is the paradox of being wrong is that in order to be right more often, you have to be more willing to be wrong because right. That's just how the numbers work out, right? I'm going to again mention the Dan Carlin episode. And the reason I keep bringing this up is just because Eric and I were chatting about it before we hit record. But something that he mentioned that it's been a thought that's resonated in my head before I listened to it. He, you know, he's not exactly progressive. He's a libertarian, if anything, Dan Carlin. Eric, you're shaking your head. I say
I'm
that with caveats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's got some socially conservative tendencies about him as well. Not in the sure. sense of like, ooh, gay's bad, but more like, hey, Athens was onto something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm saying this just to say that what I'm about to say, I don't think fits neatly into one of the partisan narratives that, right. that exists out there. So his point was, you know, I've talked with people throughout my life who are big pro Second Amendment people. And Eric, you grew up in a rural part of the country, and I spent a lot of my time growing up in a rural part of the country. I grew up shooting guns and
I'm a gun
back country. And yeah. So I have no problem with the Second Amendment. And one of the big arguments, and this is the point that Dan Carlin makes, of pro Second Amendment people is it's a check on central government tyranny. And it's hard for me to imagine any situation that threatens tyranny more than a president saying, I'm going to lock up all my opponents right. and the whole election is going to be a fraud unless I win. So he was saying, you know, Second Amendment people, you've been telling this to me my entire life since I was on the radio in the 90s. Where are you right now? This is exactly the sort of person in office that you've been claiming you own guns in order to oppose.
Exactly.
And of course, more often than not, pro-gun people are pro-Trump. Not always and not all across the board, but there is some correlation there is all I'm saying.
Right. I think there was an Onion article that was like, NRI apologizes for forgetting to rise up against tyranny or some of that. And this was during the BoRTAK deployment to Portland kind of thing.
BoRTAK.
I think we're actually going to get into I'm saving it for now. There's a how did we get here section of this that I mentioned might be another episode, depending on how long this takes us. But because we're already at 50 minutes somehow. But
yeah.
But it's about like basically how did Americans get to the point that they have these two mutually exclusive narratives about how the world works, right? Or what's going on, right? Like it used to be the case that we'd say like, we have, I don't know, like we all agree that X is true. And like, I think the way to fix it is X and you think the way to fix it is Y. And now it's that like, now it's, we're living in separate worlds. How did we get there? I want to talk about that. Because I think it's the only way to explain how 42% of Americans support the president despite what he's doing, because they just hear a different narrative. Because I think if you were sitting here hearing like, yes, the guy wants to imprison his political opposition in order to win the election, and you know that the guy has, you know, obviously used his position to enrich himself illegally and all this stuff, like you probably wouldn't support the guy anymore anyway. We'll get to that. So what happens if Trump tries to contest the election? So there are kind of two primary paths he could go down. One of them is to try to get a majority in the Electoral College by essentially going state by state and saying, actually, there's a lot of fraud. You should invalidate the results of the election in your state and hand the votes to me, which you have the constitutional right to do. Because it turns out, we've talked about the Electoral College before, it's weird. Most people don't know how it works. And you actually technically don't vote for a president, even though you do. You technically vote for electors who go to the Electoral College and decide who the president's going to be. And it's like, it was never supposed to work this way, but here we are. So the state can still choose, technically, probably. Or rather, it may take a shot at choosing to just give its electoral votes to whoever it wants. And so Trump has, for example, already gone to Pennsylvania and said, what if you just do that, right? And now, is it likely to do it? No, but there's been a lot of things that seem unlikely that have happened this year. So that's option one, is doesn't matter that I lost the state. I'm going to say fraud, 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 invalidate the results, and you just send me the electoral votes. And I win. Ta-da! The other option is kick it to Congress. So how do you do that? You hang up the declaration, the like kind of official declaration of the results and selection of electors in a state or a few states enough, long enough, that the Electoral College has to meet anyway. And so they either send like free electors or no electors, maybe. It's a little hard to know exactly how it play out, but you make it unclear how that state is supposed to send electors or prime its electors, and nobody gets a majority. And if nobody gets a majority, then Congress, now it's the incoming Congress, not the outgoing Congress, which is very important. The incoming Congress picks who the president is, and you go, oh, okay, there's tons of Democrats, so that'll be easy. Wrong. Turns out that in this process in particular, you don't vote by district, by like representative district, you vote by state delegation. So like the state of Arizona gets one vote, the state of Delaware gets one vote, the state of Texas gets one vote, the state of California gets one vote. Right now, 26 of 50 states have Republican majorities representing them in Congress. Crazy, huh? So if the Republicans could somehow hold on to 25 or 26 states, they could just decide to elect Trump anyway. Now, of course, should either of those happen, despite Biden, you know, again, we're assuming that Biden like pretty handily wins here, and it's not like it's not down to the wire. If it's down to the wire, like I don't right, just it's going to be bad because yeah. Americans all over the country are going to lose any faith in the democratic process, and we've got much bigger problems on our hand. Then we start talking very seriously about the Roman Republic, the Weimar Republic, but. I can't believe we're having this fucking conversation, but
I know. How did it come to this?
But assuming it's a fairly broad margin of victory for Biden, you know, if it ends up in Congress's hands somehow, or you have these free electors who are there, you know, some people have to make some choices about what they're going to do. And are they going to provoke a constitutional crisis or not? Are they going to try to represent the will of the people? And it will be horrible and nail biting, and liquor stores will sell out, and ammo supplies will sell out, or ammo stores will sell out. They already have. But yeah, we can get a little bit more into how these scenarios could play out, and then how to stave them off, like how to keep either of these from happening, because like generally it would be bad, kind of for the country, for the will of the people as we understand it to not translate into who's president. I think it's worth covering this point, why Pennsylvania is so important. So as we talk through these two scenarios, probably both of them are going to flow through Pennsylvania. And here's why. If you go to the 538 forecast, the snake graph makes it very clear. Pennsylvania is always the one that's hanging out, straddling the 270 electoral vote part of the snake graph. Why is that? It's just because it just so happens that all of the states that are like it's the linchpin state, because Biden could lose everything where he has less of a lead. So like he could lose Florida, Arizona, North Carolina, Ohio, and still be fine if he takes Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania, he has less of a lead than he has in Wisconsin, Nevada, Minnesota, Michigan, New Hampshire, Colorado, etc. So what it would mean is like if there's kind of a national shift to get closer, and it'd have to get a fair bit closer at this point. But like, let's say it happens, because we're talking hypotheticals here, because again, at this point, it looks like it's going to be a blowout. But if it happens, if there's like a 5-point shift nationally, then Pennsylvania is the state that matters. And if there isn't that big shift, forget it. Like it doesn't matter. And if there's more than that shift, Trump just wins anyway. But Pennsylvania, if there's going to be a linchpin, it's going to be Pennsylvania. So we're going to talk about how this could go down in Pennsylvania.
So we've talked about how Trump could potentially contest the election. And one of those has to do with state delegates being sent to cast a vote if there's a contestation. So if Trump manages to convince state legislatures to give him enough electoral votes, then you could potentially have a constitutional crisis in some of those states. And in the case of Pennsylvania, Democratic Governor Tom Wolf probably veto bills, but a non-binding resolution could be passed. And it's just not exactly clear at that point how the electoral votes would be apportioned out. Eric, you have this example here of 1872, where three states sent competing groups of electors to the Electoral College, which clearly could add to the sense of some sort of either lack of legitimacy or crisis going on. At that point, it's possible or probable that the courts get involved, and that would probably start at the state court level. At that point, Trump would file appeals. The state courts would get involved, and there would probably be a lot of disagreement. And if there's enough disagreement at the state court level, that's when potentially it could roll up to the Supreme Court, right? And that's one of the ways that this whole thing ends up back at the Supreme Court, like it was in 2000. Although in 2000, it was because the vote was so close.
Right.
Here, it's clearly for potentially other reasons. And then all of the unfortunate politics of the Supreme Court come into play. And I say unfortunate because you wrote this great article, man, about the Supreme Court that I keep referencing because, you know, sometimes, you know, they say a picture says 1,000 words. If it's a nice graph, it can do that too. And the graph that just completely changed my mind on the politicization of the Supreme Court was this one that you published in this article, because everyone seems to think that the vast majority of cases in the Supreme Court are split down the middle, and therefore we have all these problems. But the vast majority of cases in the Supreme Court are not split down the middle, and the plurality of them are unanimous, and a majority are not close.
Correct.
But, you know, right now, we would still potentially have a split court depending on what happens with the nomination of Barrett.
Can you imagine having eight people on the Supreme Court handling that case, you're like, ah, what if it's tied?
Yeah. So it's impossible to know exactly how that plays out if the courts start getting involved, because the election is close enough to be contested to that degree.
Right.
Now, if somehow there's so much chaos that states send free electors, you know, the idea that they could just kind of like vote for whoever they want, even though technically they're supposed to be voting for who the people decided that the electors should vote for, and nobody has a majority going in, then anyone could possibly come out the victor. Or if the electors could say, you know, actually, we're not going to touch that. That's not our role. And vote for some random person, some random third party person, or, you know, who knows? Tom Hanks for president. It just doesn't sound like a novel idea right now. And if that happens and there's no decision coming out of the electoral college, then it goes to the House. And then it boils down to it would be the House, but it wouldn't be the House voting by percentage representation. It would be by state vote, right?
Yep. So these are.
God.
Yeah, it's bananas. And so these are the two paths that Trump would likely try to use to stay in power, because he can't do it through force. I know people go like, oh, he's going to use the army. Army's like, uh-uh, not happening. They don't even like him. But even if they did, they wouldn't get involved. But luckily, they really don't. So these would be the two paths that he tries, probably trying both simultaneously. And the, you know, the how do we stop this from happening? Like, because what would be really nice, would be really, really nice, is like sometime in November, we know who our president's going to be, right? And or at least we've got a pretty good idea. And what's the obvious way to get that is to have a landslide, right? Mm-hmm. So here's the think about the game theory of this. So long story short is, if you're gonna, well, I'll quote The Wire, even though it's a little inappropriate. If you come for the king, you best not miss, right? So if you're gonna take a shot, right, at if you're gonna take a shot at trying to upset this election, you have to win, because if you end up on the wrong side of it, you might be in jail. You're at least screwed in a lot of ways. But there are negative consequences, you know, for any kind of coup. And this isn't quite a coup, but it's but for any coup-like activity, losing's really, 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 really bad. And like really bad, in case that wasn't clear. And so if it's down to just Pennsylvania, and the vote is really close, the game theory says you can maybe get away with it. Like, you can decide, like, you're the Republican legislature. There's a pretty decent chance you decide the outcome. But what if Biden wins Pennsylvania by 10 points? Oh, and he also has won Arizona, you know, and of course, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota. And he's also won North Carolina. And he's also won, by God, Ohio. What that means is that you as a single state alone can't change the result. So you're not going to try. Like, if you're acting on your own, you're not going to try. So there's and the bigger the election victory, the less probable it is that the courts are going to support what you do. Like, the more likely it's like if Biden wins, like, even if it's so there's two factors here, right? There's by how much does Biden win each state, and how many states does Biden win? The more those numbers are bigger, the more the game theory says to everyone who's in those states, even if they really, really want Trump to win and they don't care about our democratic institutions and they're fine just degrading the entire system to get this guy in power because they're brainwashed maniacs, right? Like, even if that was true, the game theory says you can't, like it is very, it becomes harder game theory says you're probably not going to pull it off. And by trying to pull it off and losing, you're in a lot of trouble. So don't bother. So Trump, of course, is going to, like, if anyone can write me and take a 10-to-1,000 bet, if you want, that, like, after the election, Trump will have lost, and he will claim that it was fraudulent. Right? Anyone wants to bet $100 against my $1,000 can feel free to do that. He's signaled enough that he's told the world that that's his plan. Right? Repeatedly, yeah. In many different ways. So he's going to do it. But that doesn't mean, you know, one thing I've reminded people is just because Trump doesn't want to leave the Oval Office doesn't mean he gets to stay. At the end of the day, like, there is a system that is a level, like, removed from Trump that will declare a victor. And if there is a landslide, for Biden, the idea of all of these people in all of these states coordinating in a conspiracy to try to hand Trump the election becomes so far-fetched that they don't bother. You know, the Electoral College shows up, they vote for Biden, and it is officially over. There's really nothing you can do at that point. So that's the way to stave this off. Now, of course, Trump could win, but he's probably not gonna.
Oh, Ah, got it. Okay. So I'm going to pose a question to you, Eric, and I'm going to use it as an opportunity to refer back to one of our prior episodes, because right when we started reconsidering the beginning of 2016, before Trump came into office, we did a show about demagogues, which highly recommend y'all go back and listen to and just see how it's measured up to the last 4 years.
Make Athens great again.
Do you remember? And then The Atlantic ripped off our piece.
Yeah, I was so mad.
Oh, God. We had this entire podcast episode about making Athens great again and using examples from that period in history, and because there were a lot of demagogues. And then like a month after we published that episode, The Atlantic came out with the exact same piece using who knows? If people from The Atlantic are listening to our show, glad you're a listener, I guess. No, we are. Thanks. So what I was going to say is the challenge then, because you say Trump doesn't get to decide whether he wants to stay or not, right? And I think one of the things that he has been particularly good at in office is something that probably a lot of demagogues are, which is pushing the system and testing the system and seeing if the safeguards that structurally claim to be there are actually there. Because at the end of the day, you know, a government and a country is maintained because the government has some sort of monopoly on violence and coercion, and can force people into doing certain things like not committing crimes because there are punishments, right?
Right.
And Trump has pushed that envelope a lot. So let's say, and I know that this is speculation, we don't usually do that, but he loses and stays in office anyways, right? What at that point would be how would the system react? What would be that one level removed system that you talked about that actually comes in and takes that decision out of his hands? I'm sure there's something in place for this. I don't know what it is. Do you know?
Well, there's nothing officially in place like a la the Constitution. Like the Constitution doesn't have on the day that someone is nominated, like the following group, like the Swiss Guard will show up and escort the president out, right? Like we don't have that officially. The big brains that have been thinking about it are like kind of like Biden and his team, Pelosi, and parts of the Department of Justice. And the short version is, it's what we don't know is like whose job it is specifically to go escort the president out of the Oval Office, but that that's the like final warble. Is he sitting there and be like, I'm not going to go, make me, right? And it's like, who's okay, like who has to do this? And like, and, you know, there's probably nobody wants to take that responsibility. However, I guess I just can't imagine, you know, Pelosi, who's like the, you know, she's arguably the most powerful person in the country. Kind of constitutionally, like the Speaker of the House, or like that the House should be more powerful than the president. There's no way she's losing a majority, so the House can act, and like may just like they may pass a resolution that like demand or a bill that says like, okay, we're going to create a system, right? We're going to create a process, and like you poor bastards in the military police of DC or the FBI or, you know, someone have to be the ones go do it. And of course, what would be required for that not to work is like all of these institutions to decide they're like more personally loyal to Trump than they are to the nation. And their jobs, and at which point you would have a civil war, because you'd have all these armed people say like, no, we'll just back Trump because we're personally loyal to him, which like luckily, blessedly, they are not.
Blessedly. So I think for this episode, we're going to put a pin in it because it has gotten longer than we anticipated. But we're actually just going to keep going with the rest of what we mapped out, and we'll release the second episode very soon, within a day or two, just because we want it to be out before the election. But you know, an hour and change is about all we can reasonably ask of our listeners. So we'll pin it here and pick up with how do we even got this far on the next episode, where we're going to talk about some of the media issues, which we talk a lot about at Reconsider, some of the technological issues, And that's where we'll pick up.
Yeah, so see you in a bit. Don't even let us do the thinking for you. Pause and reconsider. This is Eric prepping for part two.
This is Xander. We'll see you shortly.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.